And if that tenant fought a for-cause notice, how long would that tenant be able to stay there, and how, what kind of retaliation could occur? What, how could that escalate? And so when we gave a no-cause notice, solved the problem. And the neighbors are happy, the tenants are happy that we have. Now, these cases happen when you have the small percentage of tenants that do not obey the rules, do not live by the standard code that we have in society. If you don't smoke to upset your tenants, don't use offensive language to upset your tenants. Same thing happens when you have bad landlords. They're a very small percentage. I recently agonized over a 3% to 5.5% rental increase for our tenants. It's hard to do. We've had tenants lived with us since 1974, 1975. Joe has been with us for 32 years in Hollywood. We don't want these tenants to move. Are they paying below market rent? Yes, substantially below. We have one person who's paying $415 a month for a studio apartment, and that includes his heat. Our average rents are from $690 for a studio up to $910, $950 for a two-bedroom. We have one apartment that's a one-off 1,240-square-foot unit that should be renting for $1,835 according to the market, but right now it's at $1,250. We don't raise rent just to raise rent. So I would appreciate it if you did not punish the many, many exceptional landlords in the city just because a few are greedy, you know what. And I've had actually two tenants who have raised their own rent for me because they were embarrassed that they weren't charging enough. And last month, I reduced one tenant's rent because I thought our apartment manager was charging her too much. She was a new tenant, and I said, that's too much. We're going to reduce it. And when I called her, the tenant was silent and said, okay, what's the catch? And I said, well, the catch is you need to come in and re-sign your rental agreement because we've got to reduce the rent and initial that and things like that. So I also brought, because I'm one of those mean, nasty landlords, a couple of notes that I've received. We've received many over the years, but this is from a tenant that says, I'd like to say a hearty thank you for offering to me and my guide dog rent in your apartments. And she even had her guide dog, Delroy, sign it. That was, it's very sweet. Unfortunately, Judy passed away. She had terminal cancer, passed away last February. She was a sweet, sweet lady, and she was a great tenant. And another lady wrote, Mike, because of what the blank has been doing, I was expecting a rent increase, probably blank to blank. But only blank. Is Wayne a prince of the landlord or what? I've checked the notice three times. I can hardly believe my eyes. Now, I'm not telling you this to show you what a good guy I am, because you already know that, of course. But to show that there are people, tons of landlords around the city, that experience the same thing. We don't raise rent just to raise rent. We have to keep up with expenses. We have to keep up with raising property taxes and other things that happen. And there are times when a tenant will move out, and we spent $10,000 to improve the apartment. Not because of anything the tenant's done, but because we want to update the apartment. Maybe somebody's lived there for 40 years, and we have to update it. So, and I don't have a problem with the 90-day notice for a rent increase of more than 10%. I don't know if I've ever given a 10% increase. That just doesn't happen. But if you ever watch Monday Night Football, on the pregame show, they have a segment called Come On Man. Well, you know, recently you saw the, it was last night, the media report that rent raised by 20% at city-owned apartments. Which has since been rescinded. But that was one of those, come on, man. You know, what are you talking about? And the other thing I want to let you know is we do care about our tenants enough that since this is October and Halloween is coming up, we've sent a notice around about what to do in case of the zombie invasion so that they're all clued in on what to do. So with that,
Wayne, thank you.
I think I'm done.
A couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, Commissioner. I've got some too, but you look like you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Stoll. I have known you and your family for quite some time, and I appreciate that you are one of the good landlords in the city, and I appreciate you coming to testify today. So that's why I want to ask you, what if the rule was about a 5% increase that you had to give enough time for the tenant to find a new place?
Find a new place for 5%?
You mean a notice?
To give a notice. If it wasn't 10%, if it was 5%, as the Community Alliance of Tenants has suggested, with a certain amount of notice.
A 90-day notice for a 5% increase, is what you're saying?
Potentially.
I personally would not have a problem with that.
Thank you.
My highest increase was a 6.9%. But that was because the tenant had not received an increase for 2.5 years.
And you'd be thinking about it, and you'd be able to give that amount of notice.
I try to forecast what's happening. I just showed a tenant a space, and they said, well, they looked at another space, and the rent was going to go up $200 a month as of January 1st. And I said, well, if you can't forecast what you're going to be doing in 3 to 4 months ahead of time, then what are you doing in the rental business? So I probably wouldn't have a problem with 5%.
I appreciate that response. And then secondly, you raised the issue about no-cause evictions actually being easier than for-cause evictions.
Yes.
Do you have an alternative proposal for, because there are some landlords in the city who do raise rents, do use no-cause in order to be able to raise rents. Do you have a suggestion for how to make it so that for-cause is not more difficult than no-cause?
I haven't really thought that through. It's so alien to me to think that somebody would give a 30-day notice to someone just to raise rent. I can't wrap my head around that. Because as I said, we've had so many good, loyal tenants over the years that we're loyal to them. And I don't want to give them a massive increase because I like them.
Yeah.
And I like units. I like them.
Well, so that was the question I was going to pose to all three of you, actually. So you, Wayne, and Deborah, to an extent as well, paint this picture of how responsible landlords operate, which is really not Kat's complaint, right? So I get it that there are a lot of responsible landlords who think hard and agonize, to use your word, over even a 5% rent increase. And that's good, because that's what we would want from businesses being socially responsible and for people to think of themselves as being in the housing business, not just profit-taking, right, which is very much your family's approach. So I respect that. So I don't understand. I understand the red-hot rental market. I don't understand what the financial motivation is, given that you can increase rents, right? What is the financial motivation, not for you because you haven't done it, and maybe none of your members has done it either, but what's the financial motivation for somebody to empty out a building by giving everybody a 30-day notice in a market where, you know, there are plenty of renters available, and you don't make money unless somebody's paying the rent. So it's kind of an Econ 101 question. I'm not being playful here. I just don't understand why in this market somebody, and with relatively light state laws governing what you do, why would you empty out a building? Why are people doing that? I mean, you probably have an explanation, Justin. I mean, greed is a good all-purpose answer, but it doesn't quite fit because you don't make money until you refill the building. So why is this happening?
The Community Alliance of Tenants has been organizing under the Safe Housing Project for about 8 years. And these are buildings that are severely substandard in need of repair.
Okay.
And so what is commonly termed as the rent gap means that sometimes the value of the land is actually, because the building has fallen into such disrepair, the building isn't actually worth that much. So there is an economic decision that the landlord makes at some point when it gets to a state where it costs so much to fix it that they willfully disinvest in that building, knowing that they can sell it to a developer that will come and buy it cheap and flip it into luxury housing.
So it's going to be substantially remodeled or demolished.
Correct.
Well, okay. We also heard in the discussion of the extremely distressed properties enforcement and also the universal inspection that if one tenant complains and then gets evicted, unless we do inspect everybody so that it's not known who was the complainant, that tenant is used as an example to everybody else to don't complain or you'll get evicted.
Well, conversely, Mayor, the reason we were highly successful with the preservation agenda during the Great Recession is that the market conditions were such that there weren't the same compelling reasons to convert buildings or to do it. So we had, in all 11 instances with at-risk buildings, we were able to get them transferred to nonprofit ownership. In this market, we would not be, and we will not be as successful with their preservation agenda.
Yeah, okay, I get it. Get it. Thank you.
That happened in the office boom of the 80s, if you remember, when everybody and his uncle was building office buildings to make a lot of money. And we have a friend, John, who bought the medical dental building on Southwest Taylor and converted it to office space. He hit it right at the wrong time, and he could not rent his building. It took so long that some of his HVAC equipment was out of warranty by the time he got tenants in there. And he had to sign that building back to the bank because he couldn't make a go of it. So I don't want that to happen in this apartment market either, by having overbuilding and have apartment buildings sitting empty in 5-10 years.
Well, there is one potential benefit of that. The reason that some investors are not investing is if there's an overbuilding, there could be a correction. And
yes.
One of the benefits of a correction is typically prices go
right.
down.
So, right.
Mayor, can I piggyback
please,
on something
yeah,
you
go
said?
Ahead.
So Steve Weiss is here. And Steve, please don't have to come forward, but I just want a reminder. What was the cost of living increase for Social Security recipients this year? Yeah, so zero for next year.
Yes.
Okay. So so under the formula that's used, it means that effectively they're not building in any inflation factor into Social Security. So.
Yes, and there's been legislation languishing in Congress introduced by Bernie Sanders and Jeff Murphy to recalculate the COLAs for seniors and people with disabilities. That legislation has gotten nowhere in 4 years.
So the reason, though, I want to highlight that older adults on Social Security are going to get a zero cost of living increase next year is it brings us back to the questions that Commissioner Fritz and the mayor asked, which is what is driving the increase in rents locally if we are basically at such a modest inflation environment? And so what would cost, let me start with you, Deborah. And by the way, Deborah, thank you for your 6 years on the PHAC. And no, seriously. You represent an industry, but every single time this council tried to do something different, like fair housing and affordable housing, you were there. So I want to thank you personally for your work. And I know that you didn't always have the full support of everyone you represented in some of that work, but it's a mark of your leadership that you helped us get some things done. But let me come back to what. Just in the typical case, not where there's a building is out of code and has to have substantial capital investment or something. Why would someone need to raise rent above 5% in this market?
Need as opposed to want, right?
Well, yeah. There are, so we didn't build anything, as we all know, from 2008 until about a year and a half ago. And
Market rate.
Yeah, we're market rate, correct. And
it's in the era where all affordable housing is built.
Yes. And during that time, people didn't do anything with their units either. So you have years of deferred maintenance. So you have folks getting in a place where and not only deferred maintenance but offering concessions. That's the other piece to this pie, is that when, and the market will turn again. You said if, but it will. So offering concessions. So they didn't invest in those properties during that time period. As we've seen, people want to come back into Portland. As we've seen, folks outside of the area want to invest. They're willing to go into those properties, buy them, make them into very nice properties, and that puts a lot of pressure on the rent.
To Justin, one of the things that I want to make sure we don't do in this process of reform is create an incentive for someone to use a for-cause eviction process. And so I want to be careful as we're going through all these reforms. And I think it's worthwhile having you observe, why is a for-cause eviction for most renters a bad thing, and how does it prevent them from renting in the future?
So a for-cause notice is if the tenant has violated the lease in some way. And
I'm assuming someone is doing it on a legitimate basis, mm-hmm. or as a pretext. But I'm most interested in
yeah.
what's the consequence to the renter in the future of having a no cause on his or her record?
So if a for cause notice is given to a renter, the renter has the chance to know what the renter has done wrong and the chance to remedy that situation. They're given what's called a 30-14 notice, meaning that unless you fix the problem within 14 days, you're being asked to move in 30 days. And we think that that is fair, because the tenant knows what the tenant has done wrong, and the tenant has the opportunity to fix it. What we see with no-cause notices is the tenant isn't given that opportunity. And so the landlord decides on his or her own what the violation was, sometimes does not tell the tenant what, often does not, they're not legally required to tell the tenant what the violation was, and the tenant has no possibility to remedy it. And so the only option for the tenant is to move out, and if they move out before that termination period is over, it does not show up on their record for future rentals, but the next landlord still can call the previous landlord and ask about that rental situation. And oftentimes renters, because there's a lack of tenant education, Community Alliance of Tenants is really one of the only organizations that has like a renter's rights hotline to walk tenants through this. There are a number of other social service agencies, but for regular tenants, Community Alliance of Tenants is the only one. They believe that that termination notice is already on their record, and they are fearful to list that landlord as a reference on the next application because they don't have any say in terms of the conversation between the future potential landlord and the previous landlord.
Last question. We're talking about a renter's state of emergency in the context of historically high numbers of renters who are what we call rent burdened. What does that mean?
Rent burden means you're paying more than 30% of your income on rent, and extremely rent burdened is when you're paying more than 50% of your income on rent. As Steve mentioned earlier, many of our seniors on fixed income and Social Security and disabilities sometimes pay more than 70% of their income on rent.
And that's who sets the formula for what constitutes rent burden? Is that at the state level or the federal level?
It's the federal level, I believe.
Yeah. And the assumption behind it is that above a certain threshold of what you're spending on your home, you're cutting into the money you'd otherwise have available for things like food and clothing and basic
transportation. Yes.
And we estimate that about half of our renters in our city are between rent burden and very rent burden.
Correct.
Other questions for this panel?
I would like to echo Deborah's statements from earlier. During that time, landlords were not investing in their apartments and were not making repairs, even when being asked to do so by tenants. And that is the nature of the dynamic between the tenant and the landlord, given the economic conditions.
Okay, helpful. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, do you have some other invited testimony, Commissioner, before we take amendments, or
we have the city attorney here to answer any questions or provide.
Okay.
And Shannon Callan from my office, but.
Okay, so we have them.
We can do that as needed.
Yeah. Bring them up.
Come on up, and then okay. let's take up amendments with amendments you there to give give us some adult supervision while we do amendments. So who's got an amendment to propose? I think we have one set already in front of us. Is that right?
That's the one you're referring to?
I'm looking for the document now, sorry. Maybe I don't. So, Amanda, go. Oh, here it is. So we have an amendment in front of us labeled Agenda Item 1030, and it makes some amendments to Directive D and then adds a Directive F. So do you have copies of that one? So I'll explain that amendment and move it, and then Commissioner Fritz, who's also interested in the same amendment, can talk about it as well. What it does is change shall to may there. In other words, here's the effect. It says, right now it says, the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management Director shall submit a request to the governor through Multnomah County to declare a housing emergency. It will now read may, and that is we're not sure that we need to request the state's intervention yet. So we don't want to pre-program Carmen Merlo to make that request until such time as the council says, now we need to actually ask the state to declare an emergency as well. So changing shall to may obviously still preserves the council's ability at any time to direct the emergency management director to forward that request to the governor through the county, because that's the way it works. If the state's going to declare an emergency, the county has to ask the state. That's just what it says in state law. So this says we've got that tool, but we're not automatically using it. And then the second amendment in this same package is just a process by which, if we do proceed and declare an emergency, that the whole council, which is being asked to declare the emergency, is regularly updated on how we're implementing it. So it says the mayor's office shall submit written reports to council offices biweekly, providing status updates on efforts to implement the council's directions on the, I should say, housing and homeless emergency, and identifying any further council directives that
it's
may be needed.
Rather than homeless.
Okay, just housing, obviously. Homeless. Homeless is included in
your
the
health
work.
Emergency.
So I would move that set of amendments, but I'll wait and get.
It's either a question for either you or for the attorney or for Shannon or for
Josh. Or
they're now turning to another attorney. And so we have a lot of people who are resources. I just want to ask a question about the first part of this amendment, about the changing the shall to a may on seeking the state to declare an emergency. Here's the question. My understanding is that thanks to the work of NAMI and other advocacy groups, there's about $20 million that the governor could release for mental health, housing, and services. That's, but that would be carved up statewide based on a formula. And I also understand that there are, from the community coordinated care organizations, the so-called CCOs, that there might be as much as $38 million of redundant reserves that could be tapped, where they might be, through the healthcare system, where there seems to be an appetite for using that money to provide housing for people that come out of programs like the Unity Center and the like. Does this amendment change in any way our opportunity to seek either of those funding sources?
As I understand it, Commissioner, no. The amendment takes away a formality that triggers a whole bunch of things at the state level that we don't necessarily think we need. None of that precludes you, the mayor, the rest of council and partners going to work with the governor, who is aware of all of the things that we're doing here today, to have those conversations with her, with the CCOs and others.
And Commissioner Novick, I know you've been working on this issue a little bit with Ed Blackburn and others. The sponsor of your Sunday Parkways was who I had the honor of riding with the other day, alerted me to the $38 million and the desire to get some of that money into the system. I don't know whether that can be done administratively by the governor or an agency head or legislatively, but it seems like we have the momentum of the CCOs thinking that's a good idea to tap that money. And Josh, do we have a plan to follow up on that?
Yeah, there are quite a few conversations happening right now, both within our building, with our partners at the county, and with the CCOs themselves. It's a bigger conversation than just what we're trying to do here. There are a lot of ways that I believe that money can be moved out of the CCOs and into the hands of people to actually put money onto the street for things like this.
Let me just say, I think it's encouraging that our healthcare friends are beginning to realize that investing in stable, permanent housing is long-term going to save money and result in fewer people getting their primary health care services through the emergency room and maybe better outcomes on long-term things. So,
So let me restate where I think we are and where I think the council would be poised on this issue. That is, we want the ability to request a declaration from the state. We intend to ask the state for serious funding from that pot and others if it gets us one more dollar to have a state declaration of an emergency than we get with a local one. I will bring forward a recommendation that we seek a state declaration, but we don't know yet that's a necessary condition for us to get the state funding. I've talked with the governor about that particular need for mental health supportive housing coming out of the Unity Center. She's very supportive, but I don't, if it improves our case versus any other folks around the state that might be competing against us for that money, for Multnomah County to declare a declaration and to seek the state declaration, then obviously we will want to do that.
Mayor, I'm prepared to second this amendment to put it on the table.
Okay. And further discussion?
Actually,
I know Commissioner Fritz wanted to discuss it. So go ahead. Go ahead, Commissioner Novick.
I have a suggestion for, we're talking about the amendments at 10:30, right?
Yes.
I have a friendly amendment, additional amendment, another one-word change. This is actually from Carmen Rollo. She pointed out that the second sentence now says, the request shall identify the city is seeking assistance regarding state assistance, provision of services for the homeless and health and mental health services, and direct state agencies to utilize and employ state personnel, equipment, and facilities for activities designated to alleviate the circumstances giving rise to the emergency, for the protection of the health and safety of citizens affected by the emergency. Carmen's suggestion is we might say residents instead of citizens, okay, because we want to help residents who don't happen to be citizens.
I understand that's a friendly amendment and make that word change.
Yeah, I believe the definition would be people who are in the city are citizens, whether or not they are citizens of the United States. But, yes, I think that's the Secretary.
That's a Scrivener's change. So, Commissioner Fritz, did you have some other comments or suggestions?
Yeah, I would like Josh to further explain the second amendment, which I'll just go through again. The mayor's office shall submit written reports to the council offices biweekly, providing status updates on efforts to implement the council's directions on the housing emergency and identify any further council directives that might be needed.
Yeah, thank you for that, Commissioner. One of the things that you'll be voting on today is to actually not only include housing in the code as a reason for an emergency, but also changing from simply having the mayor declare to having council declare. I know the mayor felt strongly that this should be a shared decision, particularly in a case like housing, in order to ensure as the process moves forward that council is kept apprised and gets to weigh in at all the various steps as all of this is moving. We thought it would be helpful to produce a written report to council offices every other week on status updates on all of the different pieces so that everyone has the opportunity to weigh in throughout the process. We're open to doing it other ways. That seemed like the most streamlined way of making sure that everyone had the opportunity to be kept up to date and to weigh in. The other thing that we, my colleagues at the staff level and I will work out will be regular meetings of each of our offices together on all the various pieces so that at the staff level we're all coordinated and working with our bureaus.
And so the clear, thank you for that. For the clear intent is that if there are going to be applications of waivers of affects of the building code, if there are going to be sightings that would normally not be allowed except for the emergency, that those would be discussed at those meetings and in the biweekly reports.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Questions, concerns about that proposed amendment? So let's take a vote to accept that amendment for purposes of testimony. If we're ready to do that, roll call, please.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thanks very much to the mayor's office for working through this. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Thank you. Are there other amendments to either 1029 or 1030 at this point?
I have one to 1028.
Okay. So let's deal with the emergency declaration first. Okay. I don't think there are any more. Okay. So you have a proposed amendment to 1028?
I do. As we heard from Home Forward, 2 months, 3 months is really not enough time to be able to find a new place in the current housing market. So I would propose in 3001085B and C that we change the notice to 120 days rather than 90 days.
Second. Is there a second for that?
Second.
Okay. So question to staff.
Well, I would like to have I will oppose that amendment because I feel that what we're presenting to you today is something that is legally defensible, and I'd like to ask our city attorney to provide the city attorney's rationale in advising us that this is a 90-day notice is defensible and potentially legal, whereas 120-day, that's what you proposed, right? 120?
Yeah, 120.
Yes, the memo I saw from the city attorney said that 120
geared towards preemption. So, Lisa Graham?
Sure. Yeah. Lisa Graham, deputy city attorney. So with regard to the first item that you are suggesting, 120 days for the notice itself, whatever the city does with regard to this code amendment needs to be able to exist alongside the Landlord-Tenant Act. And so it needs to be compatible with that. And so while that act sets the floor, so 90 days is sort of a reasonable amount of time that doesn't start to feel like it's foreclosing a right that the landlord otherwise has under the act. because the landlord does have the right under the act to terminate without cause. And so when we start to get into longer periods of times, it starts to just sort of edge towards the risk that we are foreclosing a right that's otherwise allowed under the state statute, which we cannot run afoul of.
And why does 120 days seem so much worse, more likely to be afoul than 90 days?
It's just a question of reasonableness in terms of time.
I also think we're going to be risking challenges who say that even 90 days is not legal.
Right.
So it's trying to strike, I guess.
It's a balance.
I use the threading the needle, I guess, is how I'd like to refer to these.
Well, having read your excellent legal memo, which I thought was very well done, I would say that there's a lot of gray here and there's a lot of risk. So I appreciate your role of being cautious in this discussion. And question is how much risk are we willing to take with the risk of a court overturning us. Does it present less legal concern to you if instead of changing the 90-day framework, we drop the trigger on one of the notice provisions from 10% to 5% on the rent increase?
In terms of the, you're just now talking about just the term, in terms of the percentage.
The percentage increase
that triggers the 90-day notice.
Does it cause you the same heartburn if, and putting aside the question of whether we go from 90 to 120 days, I'm just asking, if we lowered the floor from 10% to 5% on the rate increase, which rent increase, which is subject to 90 days notice, does that present risk concerns to you legally?
I think that the 10% was a number that was struck upon as being sort of, you know, trying to balance sort of the administrative burden on the landlord, you know, in terms of like as you've mentioned, this is a very gray area. So trying to strike a balance in terms of what the administrative burden would be for issuing these notices, 10% was sort of a number that seemed a reasonable number.
We also heard from Mr. Stoll and presumably others that in fact, a 5% increase is unlikely for him and his tenants. So I there's two ways to get at this. It seems to me, one is extending the period of time, or two is changing the trigger. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting the sense that you have less concern about the trigger versus the time frame.
Yes, I think the time frame to move on to that other amendment to C, 120 days. You know, that's controlled, you know, by a different part of the statute, which is the rent control statute. And having a period of time where, you know, you cannot, where a landlord is not able to increase the rent extended to 120 days starts to feel more like we're running afoul of the prohibition on rent control. And again, 90 days seems like a more reasonable period of time where we're running less risk of running afoul of that.
Yeah, I would just, you know, say that these risks are not, you know, not imaginary. You know, we have a legislative session going into session in a couple months. If we don't put something on the books that can withstand any amendments, then those amendments won't be proffered by Mr. Stoll in Salem. They'll be proffered by others. We just, you know, we can fight a good battle, and we can fight a good battle for years, but I've been down there fighting for inclusionary zoning, and, you know, I've seen the legislature give us goose eggs too many times to sort of blindly accept the fact that all we got to do is just, by golly, fight it hard enough and we will prevail. You know, maybe I've just been around too long, but I try to find the art of the possible, as I said, threading the needles to what I think is legally defensible as opposed to maybe what you know, is going to satisfy the most people in this room today.
Well, the reason I applaud Dan for his approach is it's a Pyrrhic victory if we do something today that a court stays tomorrow, and then it doesn't benefit anybody. So let's find a balance that we can implement quickly, and then let's refine it as we learn more. But let's not put the whole package at risk. But, Mayor, I do think the 5% floor presents less risk and at least ought to be considered.
Okay.
Okay, then, with that as a good discussion, I'd like to, with my second's approval, table the previous amendment and instead substitute that we change it from 10% to 5%.
Okay. I'll second that.
All right. Further discussion about accepting that amendment before we take testimony? Okay. Then roll call, please.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
No.
Hales.
I'm going to support that. It was a very interesting discussion because my assumption before this discussion we just held with our counsel was that our legal risk would perhaps be greater. But I'm pleased to hear that. And to me, now that I've heard that discussion, it makes sense. Why are we here? We're here because of a financial emergency. And therefore, we ought to focus on the financial question. And we're trying to avoid harm to our citizens by extraordinary rent increases at a time where they have few other choices. So I'm pleased to hear that we think that's both a sound policy basis and focusing on the heart of the problem. Aye. Okay, so that amendment's approved. Are there other amendments before we take testimony? Other questions for our staff? Thank you very much. Please.
I'll just mention that I can't take credit for that excellent legal memo. That was Denis Vanier in my office that wrote that. So.
Well done. Thank you very much. Okay, so let's turn to the sign-up sheet, please, and take testimony. And let's do this declaration of emergency first. So if you're signed up on that item, please, we'll take that testimony first, and then we'll move to the renter protection issues. So
we're going to alternate.
Are we going to alternate?
Yeah,
okay, sorry. Somebody else figured this out before I did. Thank you. Let's alternate.
Okay, and we have a total of 48 signed up.
Okay, again, please try to limit yourself to 2 minutes. And if you've heard someone already articulate your points, don't feel like you have to repeat them. You can give them a thumbs up or stand up and say it's been said. But let's try to make sure we get to hear everyone. Please.
The first three, please come on up, are Marianne Drake, Dana Denny, and I believe it's Waheed Brown. And they'll be followed by Phil Owen, Jessica Blakely, and Melissa Mendez.
Welcome. Who'd like to be first? Go ahead.
All right. My name is Marion Drake. I'm a tenant, long-term member of Community Alliance of Tenants. First thing I'd like to point out is this conversation has been 99% male. You hardly hear any women's voices in this conversation that we've just had with you folks have just had. I want to point that out. Next, we do not need politically motivated shelters concerning the Sears building, which wouldn't happen anyway until after July 2016. The 10-year end homelessness plan that the city implemented 10 or 12 years ago didn't happen. And so this probably won't happen either. There's been a proposal, I think it was 4 years ago, there's an article in today's Tribune about this Sears building. There was a proposal, I believe it was 4 years ago, to turn the Sears building into housing, not shelters. And this has languished. Nothing's been done. We need housing. We don't need shelter. We need shelters too, but what we really need is housing. Another thing is Airbnb is flaunting the city regulations, avoiding lodging taxes, and has already effectively removed thousands of affordable and low-income potential, you know, buildings, and potentially will do more. So we're talking about funding. We need to get Airbnb in on the act and enforce the requirements that they pay hotel lodging taxes, all the ones that are using B&B. I don't know how you're going to do it, but you got to do it. I'm also in favor of required mixed-use housing development with a 10% very low-income, non-subsidized housing included in any new developments. The city council has been talking about extending one floor up for new buildings in exchange for what I understand is called some low-income housing. However, it doesn't give a percentage, and there needs to be a percentage, and I'm proposing 10%. Also, what is so-called affordable housing? I forget who it was saying that so much affordable housing has been created in the last few years. We need to be talking about, quote, this is my term that I developed with several other people that are in low-cost housing now, we need very low-cost, non-subsidized housing. Because at a meeting I went to, it was sponsored by KABU about a month ago with a bunch of renters and stuff. They said that generally when public officials in the papers are talking about low-cost housing, they're talking about public housing. And I'm saying we need non-subsidized housing, very low-income.
Thank you
housing.
Very much. Need you to wrap up because your time's been used. So.
Okay. One last thing. Commissioner Novick wants to bring in the federal government. We also need to reform the state laws because the state laws preempt many options that the local governments, such as potential renter protection, banning no-cause eviction, and a lot of other things that have been listed by Street Roots, can't happen because of that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Dana Denny, and I want to thank you all for listening to us today. I've heard a lot of really incredible things, and I'm amazed at the challenge that you have in front of you. My background is I built my own home in the 80s, lived in it for 30 years, thought I'd die in it, took care of my mother for 4 years, and lost it all. I moved here in hopes to start over, found a nice place to rent, have been an excellent renter, and my landlady came up with a no-cause termination. I had never heard of this. I was shocked. She said, oh, you're a perfect renter. You do everything great. Our tenants are all going to miss you, but here. And I said, could you tell me why? And she said, no, I'm not obligated to tell you. So I started looking frantically for housing. I am 60 years old. It's hard to get in, you know, all the groovy kids who want some groovy person living in their house. I am not working right now as well because of this search for housing. So because of my past, I built houses. I've chosen to build a tiny house. And to me, that will solve my problems. But I have found that in Portland, the zoning laws do not allow me to put my tiny house somewhere. So I am asking you to please adjust the zoning laws for those of us that are willing to make the effort, give up everything I've given up almost everything I have, to do this so I can live the remainder of my life safely in a little tiny home. So I hope you can listen. I know there are a lot of other people that are hoping to do this as well. Mm-hmm. So it's one free solution. So
we're looking for it. Thank you. Thank you. You make the case very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hello. My name is Vahid Brown. I've been in touch with most of your all's offices this past few weeks about the tent camp at Greeley, between Greeley and North Interstate. And I want to say, first of all, thank you to the city, to the mayor's office for working with me. Yesterday, I got commitments to work with the campers there going forward from the mayor's office. Heard this morning from Josh Alpert that trash pickup is going to come out there tomorrow. Still working on toilets out there. But I appreciate being told the answer that the city was going to work with the campers to allow them to stay there. So I really appreciate hearing that. I also heard from your office yesterday that the city, that a member of your staff said that the people have a constitutional right to sleep in the parks. And that was a positive thing to hear from the city. This morning, I wish I could bring some of the members from the Greeley camp here to be here and testify, but they were dealing with an emergency because last night, park rangers told some friends of theirs who are disabled veterans living outside in the park at Overlook Park that they had 10 days to leave. They were given a sweep notice by park rangers. This caused one man, Rico, who has a traumatic brain injury, to have a panic attack, and he was taken to Kaiser Hospital. So the people that are camping at Greeley were at the hospital supporting one of their fellow veterans who was sent to the hospital because of the panic attack brought on by a sweep request. So I would like to advocate for a moratorium on sweeps that are not addressing bad behavior, as was said earlier, on the streets. So there are people that are staying in parks, that are sleeping in orderly ways, they're not engaging in open intravenous drug use or whatever, that are being told, get out. So I would really encourage the other commissioners to follow the mayor's lead on this and work with people who are sleeping outside, who are finding shelter, who are doing so in a way that's not disruptive, to continue to do so in a safe way. people that had to leave. There was a pregnant woman, a woman of color, that left the Greeley camp in fear of being swept when the ODOT posted a sweep notice a week ago. She had to move into a much less secure scenario because she left a camp that was pretty safe. And her partner had all of his possessions stolen by other houseless people. So sweeps push people who are trying to make safe sheltering zones into less secure spots and positions. They're not working. So I would also like the city to encourage the city to work with Trina Sutton and the Clackamas Service Center on a site at 105th and Foster that is owned by the city that could accommodate 70 houseless people in an R2D2 type of situation where it's fenced, it's secure, they have rules and regulations. So stop the sweeps. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Brown, was that a park incident? Was that an Overlook Park?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's take the next three people, please.
Are Phil Owen, Jessica Blakely, and Melissa Mendez, and they will be followed by Keith Schultz, Linda Lloyd, and Misty Irwin.
Welcome. Good afternoon. Who'd like to be first? Okay, they nominated you.
I'm doing it, though. So I thank you today for being here. My name is Melissa Mendez. I'm a community manager here in Portland, and I'm here to discuss the no-cause notice. And specifically retaliation, resident activity that are suspicious to landlords. In one incident that I've dealt with personally is I had a resident come in from a building and complain about their neighbor having high volume traffic late hours. We're talking 12 at night to 4 a.m. So it's a little suspicious to management, but it is after hours. So, of course, we instruct our residents to contact patrol, police if need be after hours. By the time patrol shows up and or police, activities vanish. The traffic's gone. They can't prove anything. Therefore, we don't get any paper documentation for our records as well. A few days later, another resident comes in complaining about the same thing from the same apartment. We're left. We understand. We've been told about the situation. We then inform them just as well, contact patrol and or police so we can try to pinpoint exactly what's going on and be able to get a paper trail for our records. Still nothing is able to be tracked and or found. We talked to both of the residents that came in complaining, asking them if they would be willing to testify or write a statement. Due to a lot of retaliation, as we know, goes on, unfortunately, in this world today, they're not willing to testify. They don't want retaliation. They don't want their tires slashed, different things like that. So upon investigation, we as landlords, going through the file, realized that this particular resident that we believe is causing after-hours activity and issues for other neighbors, their lease is up for renewal. So then we're left then with currently the ability to issue the no-cause notice, allowing us to at some point have them vacate the apartment and kind of getting around the scenario that's currently taking place. And so I propose that the no-cause is still permitted to us. As landlords, it's our only way right now for us to be able to dictate and control issues that, unfortunately, because they happen after hours, we're unable to pinpoint the exact problems.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Welcome.
Mayor, commissioners, my name is Jessica Blakely, and I am a landlord. I am also a responsible landlord in the sense that I have never once in 15 years issued a no-cause notice, an tenancy notice, we'll say, for any reason of rent increase. It's not what my business and a lot of my fellow landlords use it for. We use it specifically to address issues which we cannot prove with the 3014. I have one specific example that I can share with you. And one of them relates around smoking, which someone also shared something about that as well. But in this case, we had someone move in who had a small child, and they were upstairs. And they move in because we're a non-smoking community. And what had happened was, is a week within moving in, they complained that they smell smoke and that their child is asthmatic and they can't handle it. They moved in here because we are a non-smoking community. We spend weeks going through the disturbance notices, 24-hour notice of inspection, all of the proper procedures we would use to try and get some type of evidence that this person is, in fact, smoking in their unit. We get nothing. We end up having to transfer this person by way of reasonable accommodation because the child has a health problem. we think, okay, well, we're not sure, we weren't able to substantiate. A week after the apartment was vacant, a new tenant moves in, completely different demographic. This person's not even home except for evenings and weekends. Within 1 week, we get another smoking complaint for this tenant. Again, denial, denial, denial. And so we utilized this particular notice because her lease was coming up for expiration, and we were not able to substantiate the smoking inside the home. And we had two separate cases, same deal, same evidence, where that evidence was presented. And so we utilized the no-cost notice for that reason, the end of tenancy notice. It was the end of her lease, and we utilized it.
Hmm. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
How many units do you have?
I have over 2,000 at this moment, and I've been doing this for 15 years, and I've not once used it for a rent increase. Not once.
2,000 units?
I have over, yeah, I'm a regional between here and Seattle, where we face the same problems, two specifically within the city of Portland, the rest in the suburbs, and the rest all the way up to Seattle, where I'm active in that community as well. But we don't use it for that reason. And that's why I would like to retain the ability to have the 30 day, if less than 1 year tenancy, the 60. And if they've been there over a year, the 60 seems okay to me as well. And only, you know, if somebody's intention is to sweep a building or to clean out a building, I completely agree with the 90 days. Absolutely. For that scenario, I can't even imagine doing that to my residents. They post reviews online all the time. I have to be, you know, subject to that, you know?
See, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to – this is a complicated area, but are you suggesting there be some exception for a circumstance where there's an imminent health issue?
Yes. So, well, what I'm saying is that I would like to see the 90-day move forward in the sense of, does it fit that description of it being we're going to clean out the building, or we're going to get rid of more than 15%, or we are actually going to push a large amount of people out the door. This end of tenancy notice that I use, we've only used maybe 6 this year. And so all I'm asking is that we are able to retain that ability to protect the residents. And in her situation with retaliation, I don't want to tell my resident that they can't live in a safe place for fear that the other person's going to retaliate against them. If we have to put her on the stand and she says, that person's stealing drugs, I saw it happen.
That. What's been your average rent increase in Portland this year?
It really depends from building to building and what the scenario is surrounding the building. We do renovate homes, so increases are a little bit higher. But like in Vancouver, a situation where we have just a stable billing, they range between 5 and 10.
And I'm just curious, do you allow tenants to rent out their places as short-term rentals?
No, there's no subletting.
No subletting at all?
Yeah, no subletting, no. They have to fall within the same rental agreement.
That's very helpful. Thank you both. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. My name is Phil Owen. I represent the Rental Housing Alliance of Oregon. We have 1,800 members, mostly small landlords, and you know, we try and be responsible and educated. I would like to, I agree with both of these that have gone ahead of me here, and I'd like to address another issue with the 90-day notice. For the last couple of years, we've had experience with a 60-day notice for people that have been there in the apartment for over a year. The problem, one of the problems comes up that for people moving out, they only have to give a 30-day notice. Since they only have to give a 30-day notice, I don't know that there is a, if somebody comes in and says, I have to be out in 60 days, I'll say, well, come back in 30 days because I can't give you anything because nobody has given me a notice, and they're not going to give me a notice for another 30 days. So if I did have a unit available and they says, well, I have to be out in 60 days, I say, well, I can only hold this unit for a week. So you got to come back in 4 weeks, 5 weeks, in order to be able to find a unit that I can actually put you in. So to me, the idea of having a 90-day notice is going to be a real problem. Plus the fact, like these folks have said, the good people, they only have to give 30 days notice to leave, and if they are living in what they feel is a threatening situation, they will get out before the 90 days is up for the bad tenant to leave.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you all very much. Helpful. Next three, please.
Keith Scholes, Linda Lloyd, and Misty Irwin. And they will be followed by Tyler Morris, Lauren Gross, and I believe it's Marie Allen Claire.
All right. Welcome. Good afternoon. Yeah. Welcome. Please.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. I'm Keith Schultz. I'm a disabled resident of Gresham. That's where it seems like everyone's been going out from Portland when the rents started getting higher. And, I have lived in the Portland area for 41 years. I grew up in rural Central Oregon. And for the past 10 years, I've lived in a complex which has some amenities I enjoyed, like a pool, sauna, hot tub, grassy areas, and whatever. Well, about a year ago, it was sold to a company from Colorado. They immediately started doing what they've been doing here in Portland, turning it into a fancy little spa area, you know, and we have a dog park. We have a dog watching place and whatever, you know, just, and some of my neighbors were displaced because of all this, and they're remodeling some of the apartments and everything. And, but anyway, our current rents have been going up substantially. I'm on Section 8, and my share of the rent in the past 4 years has doubled. And, you know, my Social Security hasn't doubled. We're getting a zero increase this year. And, yeah, I was thinking about this, I looked at a Willamette Week article, and a quote, a friend of mine was quoted as, there's a lot more people looking for a Chevrolet and being offered a BMW. The place that I am seems more like a Rolls Royce. And where are we supposed to go? Hood River, Sandy, Mount Hood, the middle of nowhere? And those of us who are transit dependent, we're screwed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Misty Irwin, and I'm a person with a disability that qualifies under the Federal Fair Housing Act for reasonable accommodations. And in August, I received a notice of a rent increase, and my rent was going from $844 to $959. That's a $115 increase. I'm on a subsidized housing program. And with the way the current law was, my daughter and I would have had to be out in 30 days if I hadn't filed a reasonable accommodation, or I'd have to pay $1,059 a month to go from a lease to month, you know. And I'm here to petition that, you know, at least maybe the federal government can give us some sort of more funding for the housing programs, you know, because otherwise a lot of us that are on disability, we're going to be out in the streets. We have nowhere to go because the housing programs don't have enough funding to help out with us. It would cost them more in the long run to move me in one shot in a year than it would to pay the increase for the whole year. You know, and I don't understand why they can't help out more on these grounds. And I've been doing a lot of research with landlord-tenant law and reasonable accommodations with disability. And it's amazing to me how many people don't really know their rights as far as tenants and as far as people with disabilities. I think that the Social Security and each landlord should hand out a booklet giving you your rights, you know, letting you know what your rights are, you know, that you are protected under the Federal Fair Housing Act for a person with disabilities for reasonable accommodations and modifications. Hmm. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Can I ask
Thank
you a quick question?
Yes.
Are you in a unit that's privately owned?
No, I'm in an apartment complex.
I mean, is it a housing authority home forward project, or is it a private landlord?
Oh, no, it's a private landlord.
Okay, I see. But your housing assistance comes from a federal program.
Yes, it does.
And just on that point, because Commissioner Novick said it earlier so succinctly, every single year we're seeing cuts to these federal programs under sequestration. And thank goodness the Veterans Administration is the only federal agency exempt from sequestration, which is one of the reasons the county and the city can continue to focus on veterans homelessness. it's the one agency of federal government that doesn't get the automatic cut every year. Would that we had the same clout to extend that principle to the housing. But I will tell you, I don't want to make a bad situation seem more bleak, but there are major party candidates running for the presidency who've said they would abolish the Department of Housing and Urban Development and don't view it as a core function of government. And if that happened, we'd continue to have a tax code that gives $200 billion of foregone revenue relief to middle-income people who deduct their property taxes and their mortgage interest, but we'd have no money for people that are no longer served by the market. So in addition to all the good work that's happening locally, I hope housing finally breaks through as an issue of concern at the federal level. I don't remember housing coming up in any debate